Some of the greatest soul and rhythm and blues recordings wouldn't have been made if it weren't for my guest Jerry Wexler. Wexler was a partner in Atlantic Records from the early 50s through the mid-70s. His specialty was finding great singers and matching them with the right band and backup singers to create a sound that was both artistically true and commercially successful. The short list of people he's worked with includes The Drifters, Ray Charles, Aretha Franklin, Bob Dylan, Wilson Pickett, Otis Redding, Etta James, and Solomon Burke. I spoke with Jerry Wexler in 1993 for a live broadcast from the Public Radio Conference in Washington, D.C. Here's just a few of the records we have Jerry Wexler to thank for.
I've been loving you too long to stop now. See the girl with the diamond ring? She knows how to shake that thing. All right, now, now. Hey, hey. Hey, hey. I'm gonna wait till the midnight hour. That's when my love comes tumbling down. I'm gonna wait till the midnight hour. When there's no
stories about making this music in Jerry Wexler's new memoir. It's called Rhythm and the Blues, and it's just been published by Knopf. Jerry Wexler, welcome to Fresh Air.
It's great to be here to plug my book.
I want to get started with your work with Aretha Franklin. I think that's a good place to start. Now, she had made about, 10 or so recordings on Columbia Records before coming to Atlantic. John Hammond produced her, and he was producing her like a jazz singer, kind of in the Dinah Washington tradition. Yeah. You, when she came to Atlantic, you worked with her. You heard something completely different. What did you hear when you started producing her?
Well, I heard the Aretha Franklin who sang in church, who sang Precious Lord when she was 13 years old, and a man in the audience was so overcome, he said, listen at her. And I listened, and it wasn't so much that I tried a new approach to her. It's that what she did fit very well in with what we were doing anyhow.
Well, you sat her down at the piano. You had her play herself, which I don't think she'd done on the records before that.
Not very much.
What was it like at Muscle Shoals? What did you hear there in that southern sound that you wanted?
Well, it was the way they recorded, which was ad-lib recording without written arrangements, building the song from the get-go, just from the chords, and the musicians made a fabulous contribution. So these were arrangements which we all did together. And they were just as much arrangements as anything that was ever done by Henry Mancini, in the sense of being an arranged piece of music.
So you took Aretha down to Muscle Shoals, recorded like a track and a half with her, and there was this really big fight. What was the fight about?
There was an explosion that went on because of too much Jack Daniels and not enough Prudence. And it had to do with Ted White, who was Aretha's husband at the time, who got it into a dangerous, over-friendly drinking from the same jug with a gentleman who can best be described as a card-carrying redneck, trumpet player. And it got into what we call the dozens, the Southern Dozens, and then it got nasty. And the session blew up, and we went back to New York with one song complete, which was I Never Loved a Man, and a three-piece track on the other side, which was Do Right Woman. And all we had there was rhythm guitar, bass, and drums, which is not a whole lot to go on.
Not even vocal?
No vocal. No piano. No background vocal. And then we finished by bringing Aretha and her sisters into the studio. And it was a pretty good piece of extemporization in that starting with this very minimal track, Aretha laid down an organ part and a piano part. And then she sang the lead, and then she and her sisters got together and did the background. And it was a very full, finished record put together, well, I'd say, with spit and chewing gum.
You produced Respect. Is there a story behind how the Sakatumis landed on there?
Well, the story is that when Otis Redding did it, it was entirely a different song. The Sakatumis were Aretha Franklin's idea, where she injected into the song, which connoted a certain idea of social respect, probably the notion of ethnic respect, combined with a little judicious lubricity on her part. The respect that she was talking about was what you might call, very bluntly call, proper sexual attention. But it was her transmutation of Otis Redding's Little Southern Song. As a matter of fact, I was mixing the record in our studio on Broadway, and Otis walked in. He said, "That little gal done took my song."
Now, your first studio was actually the office.
That's right.
Of Atlantic Records. Who did you? Because when Atlantic was young, you didn't have a studio. So what'd you do? You'd move out the chairs into the hallway whenever you wanted to record?
We did have a studio. It was our office, and it was a studio because we had equipment in it. And my partner, Ahmed Erdogan, and I shared this big room. We had two desks that were catty-cornered, canted toward each other. And what we would do is push them against the wall, stack them, and then our engineer, Tom Dowd, would set out camp chairs, a few microphones, and one mic in the hall for echo.
Now, you work with Otis Redding a lot during his career.
I was not Otis's producer. I want you to realize that. Otis was produced at Stax Records in Memphis by that great team of Jim Stewart and Booker T and the MGs, especially Steve Cropper.
Now, you saw him change a lot as he became better.
Yes.
Now, what was he like in the beginning before he was very famous? What was he
Otis
like on stage?
Was very simple, very unaffected, but he had the magic. And when he came to New York after his first hit record, I picked him up at the airport. No roadies, nobody, no nothing, just Soul Otis. And he opened at the Apollo, and he just stood there, just straight on, with his arms at his side, didn't move. Another one who started like that was Marvin Gaye. But they learned some stagecraft, but what really kicked Otis into moving was having to follow Sam and Dave, who used to be described as a stage full of Jackie Wilsons.
That's really great. No, you know, we were talking before how you brought Aretha Franklin down to Muscle Shoals, Alabama. You brought Wilson Pickett down to Memphis to record.
Right.
You really loved that Southern sound that was coming out of some of the bands there. Why'd you think of bringing him there?
Well, because everything was winding down in New York. I mean, it was entropy. We just couldn't get out of our own way. We had been very successful year after year, but our style of recording was a regular old-time standard style, using arrangers with written arrangements. Now, when you have to change an arrangement, and you almost always do, to accommodate the vicissitudes of the song and where you're going, it's total agony for the entrepreneur to see that clock going around while a man is going around with an eraser, erasing little notes on 13 charts. And this Southern style of recording, where it's just all you have is chord indications, you go out, you sing a lick, do it like this, fellas, bang, here's the new chord, you know. But maybe that's overstating it, but actually there's a spontaneity and a fantastic new element that comes in because the musicians are organic to the idea.
So you heard that
I heard the sound.
Pickett.
I heard the sound, and I brought Pickett to Memphis, and we cut Midnight Hour and a lot of other things there, all in a hurry. It was great.
Jerry Wexler recorded in 1993, the year his autobiography, Rhythm and the Blues, was published. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.